I'm Ross Reynolds. You are listening to The Record. Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein has written a book called Plato at the Googleplex that imagines this. What if Greek philosopher Plato came back to Earth in 2014 and went on an author book tour? And here she is with us on an author book tour. That's the premise behind this book, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. Rebecca is both a philosopher and a novelist. Her previous books include The Mind-Body Problem and 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction. She's also a MacArthur Award Fellow, the Genius Grant. The citation said her short stories dramatize the concerns of philosophy without sacrificing the demands of imaginative storytelling. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Let's talk a little bit about Plato, first of all. You start your book by conceding that Plato, in his own time in ancient Greece, was often mistaken or confused. So why do you care? Why should we care about what Plato might think of contemporary life?
Well, he really created the field of philosophy as we know it. And it's a field that's made progress. That's a controversial statement, that philosophy has made progress. And he was committed to the possibility of philosophy making progress. So in fact, if all the answers lie with Plato, Plato was wrong about philosophy's making progress, therefore Plato can't be right about everything. So there's a syllogism for you. So on Plato's own understanding of philosophy, we've left him behind.
And Plato, it's important to note why he and the Greek philosophers are so vital to this. They looked at philosophical questions differently than those who came before, didn't they?
Yes. One of the puzzles that I've thought about for a very long time is, why did those ancient Greeks do everything? They were so many achievements poured out of their science and abstract mathematics and philosophy, democracy, timeless art, architecture, tragic poetry. They were so ambitious and so gifted. Why did that happen? What were the conditions that forced this high achieving society? And what I found is that they're very similar to our society, and the society that Socrates and Plato were somewhat rebelling against, the pre-philosophical societies, particularly like ours. So they were a celebrity society. Do something big so your name will live on forever. They didn't look to their gods for confirmation.
They looked to themselves.
To each other.
People have answers to these things.
Yes, but they also, you know, the pre-philosophical Greeks, it was a culture of looking to each other, affirmation from each other, being famous, acclaim, kleos was their word for it. And Socrates and Plato bought into this assumption that you have to do something, achieve something extraordinary in order to matter. It's not the acclaim of others. It's something inward.
Mm-hmm. Well, Plato's concerns were not so much personal, but they were focused on the largeness of the world, on the great issues out there. So what do you imagine him making of our self-obsessed world of Facebook and Twitter, documenting endlessly our tiniest little personal
tricks?
Yeah,
this is one of the ways in which it so struck me, you know, since I was so immersed in the ancient Greeks, how similar we are to the society that Plato said, no, this is not the thing to concentrate on. That being mentally replicated in others does not confer any true worth. It's understandable. We have the same concerns. I'm so sympathetic to this. I don't want to downgrade this or denigrate this. I'm so sympathetic to this deep existential need we have to feel that our brief time here matters. You know, we don't remember most of the people who came before us, the great majority. We will not be remembered after we're gone. What can we do to give our lives some moreness?
So if it's not my 5,000 Twitter followers, what would Plato say? Where would Plato say I should look?
Well, you should look at developing, you know, your own virtues, is what he said, to try to cultivate wisdom and justice. And interestingly enough, he felt that the way to really do yourself good is to get out of yourself, to take in the world at large, to take in the world of other people and what you can do to contribute to the greatest good of your society, but also to just take joy and wonder in the world, a kind of thomasine is what they called it.
It
means kind of ontological wonder. Ontological meaning anything that has to do with existence, that you exist at all.
And so we're just being happy about being.
Being. And okay, we don't have to be forever, but be as big as you can be, not by replicating every little tiny detail of your life in other minds, but rather by identifying with the world at large. It's much larger than we are. So assimilate that large world as a way of making yourself larger.
We're talking about what would Plato make of us in 2014 if he was on a book tour. And we're talking about it with the author of the book Plato at the Googleplex, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. Advances in neuroscience suggest that we might not have as much free will as we believe, that we have habit and blind spots in our just the way that we think that control our actions more than our conscious mind. You put Plato in a cognitive neuroscience lab. What does he make of that?
Yes. So one of the things I do, I should say, his first stop, as you had mentioned, is the Googleplex. And he gets himself a Chromebook there. And he is very addicted to the internet and knowledge. You know, this is, and this makes it very easy for me to get him up to speed. Because he's checking everything out, he's taking MOOCs. So I should say that by the time in the last chapter, I bring him to a neuroscience lab, he's taken a MOOC and he knows neuroscience and he can use one of the oldest anti-reductive arguments that he puts into the mouth of Socrates right before Socrates is dying in the Phaedo. He's able to update that into neuroscientific language. So what does he make of these? He believes, or maybe I believe, I should say, come right out here and say, instead of hiding behind Plato, that one of the greatest roles of the philosopher is to mediate between the scientific image of us in the world and the other images of us in the world that don't derive from science, but that we need in order to live coherent lives. For example, the view that we are living a life, that we're not just 100 billion neurons firing or 100 trillion synapses, that there is something over and above this that is our life to which we are committed, that we care about very much. How do we mediate? What are the ideas that come from this unscientific image that really just have to go? They're just not consistent with the scientific image. For example, I would say Cartesian dualism, the view that we are not brains, that we are not matter. But free will, you brought up, does that have to go? Is there some aspect of taking responsibility for our lives, of having accountability over our lives that's reconcilable with what we're getting from neuroscience?
So the two of them together, not tossing out free will while acknowledging that maybe there are some things we are pre-programmed to do.
Yes, yeah. Right. But, let's see what we can salvage from what we need in order to make sense of our lives.
You and scientist Steven Pinker gave this great TED Talk in which you argued that reason, the basic tool of the philosopher, has fallen on hard times. Why so?
Why so? I ought to say it's fallen on such hard times that when we gave that talk, it really bombed. Everybody hated it. I don't know. There's a sort of sense of, that goodness is in the heart. It's a good heart. Everything is in the gut. It's, intuitive. There are lots of ideas that have already been invalidated by scientists that people still hang on to. I'm thinking of, the vaccination is being correlated with autism. It's been completely invalidated by scientists. Climate control, all of these, that there is, as much as our society and culture is dominated by technology, the underlying science that's telling us about the world is often negated and not taken terribly seriously. So, and when it comes to the questions that I'm particularly concerned with, like how to live a good life, what it is to be a good person, there's a lot of skepticism that reason, cold, hard, a heartless reason has anything to tell us. And I think that that's wrong. And I think it's very wrong that reason is hard cold and heartless.
Let's return to what I think is your central argument here. The subtitle is Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. You're making a case that this is still important. And you talk that about how some of your best friends who are scientists say, philosophy, that's this fringe thing out there. Make the case for us that philosophy is not a fringe area that should be more central to our lives.
Right. Yes, I hear this so much because my area of specialty is philosophy of science. I hang out with scientists. I live with scientists. I hear this all the time. Yes. And it is true that in the history of science and philosophy, a lot of questions that were first posed by philosophers are taken over by the scientists. The empirical methodology catches up and, you know, they charge off and they get answers. And, you know, that's true for physics, cosmology, psychology, artificial intelligence, logic, these became sciences. And then we got real answers. Well, first of all, one thing is that in order for scientists to be able to tell us what a scientific theory is, what's the difference between a scientific theory and a non-scientific theory, you need philosophy. In fact, it's usually the philosopher of science, Karl Popper, who is pointed to as the fallback guy, that it's falsifiability. A scientific theory has to make a prediction that is, in principle, falsifiable. That what science does is gives the world a chance to answer us back when we get it wrong.
And that itself is a philosophical framework.
That is philosophical. It needed philosophical arguments. And then scientists can just sort of scoop it up and go with it. The claim that science describes the world, that it's not just presenting various constructions, models, that we're really discovering that certain things exist, that there is, that there are particles or maybe strings, you know, that science is in the business of discovering and describing the world, itself is a philosophical position. There are scientists and philosophers who believe that scientific theories are just instruments for prediction. They just correlate experiences together. And it don't expand our knowledge of what is our ontology. So that's a philosophical position. So even to argue that science is the only thing that tells us what it is requires so much philosophy. So it's a self-negating proposition that science can get along by itself without philosophy.
I want to return to an earlier point you made. People point to physics and they go, all these advances in physics just in the last 60 years or so in biology, and then they look at philosophy and they go, not much going on there.
Yes.
But you would make the argument that they're wrong?
I would. And I would argue, first of all, you know, the very presumptions that science needs in order to be able to make these claims, look how much progress we've made, themselves depend on philosophical arguments. But even more than that, I would say our advances in human rights, that we now see so much more than previous generations about who matters. This is a fight that keeps going on. This changes our intuitions, our ethical intuitions. There were huge fights, you know, about slavery, about women, about children. Do they have rights? These were philosophical arguments. They changed our intuitions. Now they're intuitively obvious. We just take them for granted. We don't see all of the hard philosophy, philosophical arguments that are covered over by our advances.
The whole question of who is a human, answers to that have informed the fact that we rarely see slavery anymore, and there is these advances in the way that people are treated.
Exactly right. I mean, who would you know, do to children what used to be done to children in factories, and using their own children as slaves? And we see it happening right in front of us. 35 years ago, the philosopher Peter Singer at Princeton, started talking about factory farming, the way we treat our animals. Everybody thought it was nuts. Because, you know, when these things are first proposed, it's like it clashes with our intuitions. It's inconvenient to think about it. We don't want to have to start thinking about that, especially with animals. They can't even lobby for themselves, right? And whereas other disenfranchised groups like slaves or women could. But in 35 years, I've watched, you know, a lone philosopher's abstract argument transform into a social movement, changing our emotions. It's always important that our emotions be changed. Nothing gets done if our emotions don't get changed. And now it's an issue.
That's so interesting you mentioned that. I mean, we've seen the animal rights movement, and not that long ago I spoke to a lawyer who specialized in animal law, treating them not quite human, but greater than simple objects.
Exactly.
Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, thank you so much for stopping by. I've enjoyed our conversation.
I have too. Thank you.
Her book is called Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. You're listening to The Record on KUOW.